Hey, it's Motley Fool Money co-host Dylan Lewis here. If you're listening to us, it's because you love following the stock market and learning about business stories. If you're looking to keep learning and unlocking your potential, then you should check out the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast produced by our friends over at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Think Fast, Talk Smart is the Webby Award-winning best business podcast that's received nearly 43 million downloads and is the number one career podcast in 95-plus countries, so you know it's worth your time. Each week, host and Stanford lecturer Matt Abraham sits down with experts to discuss the best tips to hone and develop your communication skills, from making small talk that leaves a big impression, to keeping your nerves in check while speaking, to being more persuasive. Whether you're working on your elevator pitch or planning an important meeting, strong communication skills are important in business and life in general. That's why you'll hear from pros like neuroscientist Andrew Huberman on how to manage speaking anxiety, as well as speechwriter, best-selling author, and friend of the Fool, Dan Pink, on how to take risks in your communication, and psychologist Kelly McGonigal on how to harness nervous energy to fuel powerful presentations. All that and so much more available on the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast. So what are you waiting for? Listen every Tuesday, wherever you get your podcasts or on YouTube.
We're not going to guess what the stock market's going to do this year, but we will put our money where our mouth is. Motley Fool Money starts now. I'm Ricky Mulvey, joined today by Jason Moser. Jason, how you doing?
Hey, Ricky. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. You have a good holiday break?
It was a very good break. Yeah. Busy. A lot of stuff going on, but you know, we made it through. got through to the other side, which is always nice. How about you?
Yeah, it was pretty good. Went to Cincinnati, went home for a little bit back in Colorado, and going through some unread emails today. How lovely.
Yeah.
You know who was busy over the holidays? Were some big tech lawyers, as Apple resumed sales of its Watch series and the Watch Ultra 2 just before Christmas. They had halted sales due to a patent dispute. It lost a case against Masimo, the medical technology company, accused Apple of hiring away employees and stealing their tech, which basically measures blood oxygen levels, and the tech is allegedly used in the new Apple Watches. So to set the table, JMO, what does this temporary win mean for Apple?
It gives them the opportunity to keep selling the two watches in question here that utilize the technology that Masimo is questioning. Now, this is temporary. I think that's worth noting. I mean, this is something where there's going to be an appeals court. They review this case again here at some point this month. Don't know when that's necessarily going to be. But, I mean, this has been such a long sort of drawn out story, right? I mean, this is not something that just came up. I mean, Masimo and Apple have a very fascinating history. And I know we've talked about it on these shows before, but I mean, this is just one more sort of step in the journey, right? I mean, it is one of those things. It's not something that's going to resolve itself easily. I would say, like, with the appeals court looking at something here later this month, I don't think that means that'll bring everything to a conclusion. But it really does. When you look at what Masimo does, why the company was founded, what it was founded on, ultimately technology for pulse oximetry, which is the technology in question here, you know, it starts to make you wonder exactly what Apple may or may not have done. I mean, there are plenty of court cases here along the way that have ruled in Masimo's favor. So, I mean, it looks, at least, you know, from the layperson looking, you know, outside looking in, it does look like Apple probably lifted this technology in some capacity. Now, I'm just saying that it's what it looks like. I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a judge. I have no say so here. And I think ultimately what we also see is that with founder and CEO of Masimo, Joe Kiani, he is just digging his heels in for what is likely going to be a long and drawn out battle. And that comes with its puts and takes, right? But ultimately, Masimo is a company that, you know, it built the business on pulse oximetry technology. It's a medical device company. So, I mean, they're looking to expand their portfolio and do more things. A company like this at this size, they need to protect their technology, right? I mean, that is one of the keys to this company's success, is making sure they protect their technology. So I absolutely don't blame him for taking this the distance. By the same token, it is something that investors need to keep in mind. I mean, this is a big risk for Massimo. Whereas, I mean, for Apple, I mean, I don't want to say they could take it or leave it. I mean, I understand Apple, they want to do everything they can do to try to make that watch as good as it can be. But there's no question that the result of this, it's far more important for Massimo, I think, than it is for Apple.
Yeah, Massimo is spending about $100 million so far on this case, which is a literal drop in the bucket for a company the size of Apple.
Yeah.
As you said, to digging one's heels in, CEO Joe Kiani told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "If I can change the most powerful company in the world from continuing to act badly, that'll have more impact on the world than anything else I'm doing," end quote. What should Massimo's shareholders, though, hope for in this case? This is, as you mentioned, a company that's won patent disputes before, but not against a multi-trillion dollar company that can call the president of the United States and say, Christmas is coming up and we'd like to sell our watches.
Yeah. I mean, as a Massimo shareholder myself, I mean, I think shareholders, investors, you're rooting ultimately for a win, right? You want Massimo, you want this to be reaffirmed, right? They've won a lot of cases along the way. This is an appeal. It feels like this is something that should go in Massimo's favor, given the track record up to this point. But again, it's a legal issue. We just don't know. I mean, that's going to be something the courts ultimately decide. If it's something that doesn't go Massimo's way, it's not something that is it's not fatal to the company. I mean, the company is going to continue to do what it does. I mean, it's got plenty of installed equipment and technology in hospitals and doctors' offices all over the world. What it does do, I mean, if Massimo loses this case, I mean, it gives Apple a lot more leeway in what they can do with their watches. But if Massimo ends up winning this case, it's going to force Apple to do one of two things: either rethink the technology that they implement in their watches, or they're going to need to try to figure out some way to work with Massimo. Now, on the latter, I think that's going to be a little bit of a tougher road to hoe. Now, it's not to say that it can't be done, but given the track record with these two companies, I don't think it's something where Apple can just say, "Oh, we're just going to buy Massimo." Massimo's a $6 billion plus market cap. And if Apple just all of a sudden one day said, "Hey, you know what? We're just going to end this now. We want to buy Massimo." I mean, Kiani is not going to give this thing away for a song, right? So he's going to make Apple pay for it. So again, I mean, it'll be very fascinating to see how that turns out. But, such is the way with this type of stuff, right? I mean, it just goes to show why companies that come up with tremendous intellectual property early on, it's a good sign when you find companies that fight hard to protect that technology all along the way, as both companies really have done. But I will say in Massimo's case, they have fought tooth and nail all along the way to protect their technology. And if this works out in their favor, I think that just goes to show why, and ultimately speaks more to the longer term opportunity for them.
And if you look at Apple's stock price today, you'll notice that it has dipped. I don't think it has to do with this case, though, Jason. It is also because Barclays pointed to weaker consumer demand for the iPhone sales, trouble selling in China, and gave the mega cap tech company a downgrade.
Yeah, a downgrade in a substantial price target reduction from $161 per share to $160 per share.
Don't get too excited.
Yeah, I know. It always amuses me to see that. Just because we all know. I mean, valuation is as much art as it is science, and coming up with those types of price targets just depends on so many different things. I'm not necessarily saying that Barclays is right here, but I do understand the rationale. I think it's a reasonable take. It's a reasonable concern. I mean, as these phones get older, right? I mean, as we move to the 15, the 16, and ultimately 17, 18, 19, and whatever, you don't need to refresh that phone as often, right? You can keep that phone for longer. That impacts Apple sales. There's just no question there. And when you think about how much of a role the iPhone, the smartphone has played in Apple's success to this point, I mean, it really is still a phone company for the most part. I mean, they do a lot of things well, but the phone is the lion's share of the company's profits. And so they're still trying to come up with sort of that next great thing. And in what they've got to this point is a lot of really good things that are kind of making up one more great thing. We've talked a lot about Apple being a services company and kind of making that pivot away from hardware more into becoming a lifestyle, the services and stuff that we use. some concerns there in regard to antitrust as far as is how big Apple's going to get. The App Store lawsuits and whatnot kind of make you wonder exactly how much farther the services stuff can go, at least on the pricing side, and that is a very profitable side of the business. So I absolutely understand the take. Not saying it's necessarily the right one or the wrong one. That you know, time will tell there. It does make sense to start expressing a little bit of concern here because they just have yet to really find that next lightning in a bottle solution that the iPhone has been.
It's hard to fill the other pocket when you already have something in everybody's pocket.
Yeah.
the other headlines coming out today, it's slow. People are still getting back to work from the holiday break. So it means that we're publishing a lot of large macro predictions, what the investment houses think that the stock market is going to do last year. I think it's worth remembering that last year we had the 100% chance of a recession that never came. Could happen this year, could not. But investors are going to be seeing a lot of these large scale predictions about interest rates, the year ahead in investing. How do you recommend that they read into those?
No, I think it's interesting you brought up the recession point there because, you know, I mean, we've been talking about recession for really probably the better part of the last couple of years, right? And while technically we never ran into a recession, I mean, remember, in 2022, we did have two consecutive quarters of economic contraction, which technically is how a recession was defined. Yeah. Now, I understand not calling the recession because of other economic indicators, but maybe that's semantics. You know, when you look at a recent bank rate survey, they found that 60% of adults actually feel like the economy is in a recession right now. And so maybe perception is reality in this case. You know, I don't know. I guess we'll have to sort of wait and see how that shakes out. But when you look at how the market performed last year, tremendous recovery from the previous year. We saw the S&P up around 25%. It's worth mentioning, I mean, a lot of that came from the Magnificent Seven. And I think the Magnificent Seven, you know, we've got Google, Amazon, Microsoft, NVIDIA, Tesla, Apple, Meta. Those are companies that I think will continue to kind of keep things going forward for us here in 2024. I mean, in 2023, the worst performer there was Apple, and it was up almost 50%. You had NVIDIA up almost 240%. So it's the Magnificent Seven really are playing a big role. But that's not a bad thing, right? I mean, that's something where, I mean, listen, we encourage investors to own these types of businesses. And so I think we will likely see, at least in the front half of the year, the Magnificent Seven continue to perform well. The consumer is a little bit stretched, right? Yep. I mean, we've seen credit card debt topping $1 trillion. Buy now, pay later. That stuff kind of flies under the radar. So it's not necessarily even accounted for there. Student loan payments starting back up. There are a number of reasons why you could be concerned about the consumer. But then really, ultimately, the wild card comes in November, right? Yep. It's an election year, and there's going to be a lot of headline risk out there one way or the other.
I want to move to a mailbag question we got from a listener. We had a event for Motley Fool Money members and listeners in Denver a few weeks back, and we got a listener who wanted to ask a question directly to you, J-Mo.
Okay.
And this was his question.
My name's Dane. I have a question about Teladoc, an investment I made in 2019. For the first 2 years I owned it, one of the best investments I ever made. The last 2 years, one of the worst investments I've made. So I guess my question related to this is, how do you juggle the balance of knowing the right valuation of a stock versus also time in the market is important, and over the long haul, good companies are going to perform well?
Yeah. Great question there. And not an easy answer because it does depend on a lot of things. I mean, we went through a little bit of an interesting stretch there over the last 3 years where valuations in certain companies got really out of hand. And it was difficult to really see exactly how things were going to continue, right? How things would ultimately resolve themselves. I think that when it comes to investment, Teladoc, I think, is a good example of a business where, a business is still not profitable, right? Still working their way towards profitability. And so it's very difficult to understand how valuation ultimately works with a business like that, right? You have a limited amount of data with which to work. You're kind of valuing things on price to sales, and you're really starting to forecast out a lot. And so for me personally, and I'm still a Teladoc shareholder. I mean, I've owned shares in Teladoc since they IPO'd, I think something like 2015 or something. It's a business I bought back then based on my general thinking of where healthcare needed to go over the long haul. And when I say long haul, I own this in my retirement portfolio. I have an indefinite holding period. And so for me, you know, I mean, the ebbs and flows are just part of the deal, and you got to deal with that. I think for me, a lot of it really boils down to position sizing. And in hindsight, of course, we look at a lot of these companies that went through these last 3 years, sort of these stay-at-home stocks, for example, where we saw companies like Teladoc or PayPal or Square, Etsy, a lot of these companies that really just took off. They went to the moon. It felt like the opportunity was unlimited. And now, you know, fast forward to today, and we're kind of back to where we are. It's worth kind of paying attention to investor sentiment, psychology headlines that are going on. And when you see things that are really abnormal, that's when you can start looking at companies like these and saying, okay, well, has this position gotten to a point where it's way bigger than I ever wanted it to be? If so, should I consider trimming some? I think a lot of times you can maybe take a little bit off the table, but still keep that core position. Again, you know, valuation is very difficult when you have companies that just aren't making actual profits yet, because you really are basing that investment on a case that you're making far, far in the future. So for me, ultimately, a lot of it just boils down to position sizing, making sure that you're not so overly exposed that you can withstand these volatile stretches. Ultimately, if you do find that the business is suffering and they're not doing, you know, management's not doing what they say they're going to do, you know, then you have to start looking at that and saying, well, maybe this thesis is broken, and then you can make your decisions from there.
So I know you mentioned Teladoc's one that it's in your retirement portfolio, but I'm thinking to Dane's question, I'm thinking to the institutional investors who are allowed to make guesses about the economy that they really have no stake in. Like you can say something, it gets published. You know, for us, I like putting our money where our mouth is.
Yeah.
So what is a stock as we start the year? What's a stock or maybe an exchange traded fund that you already own? And stories can always change, but that you plan on holding through 2024?
Yeah, well, I would say most of them. I mean, I definitely try to minimize the selling, but one that I do own that I intend to hang on to for some time to come, Axon, I think, is a great one. The company that's known for taser technology and ultimately just giving law enforcement an alternative beyond guns in order to try to maintain civil discourse. But I think Axon is one that stands out to me that I really, beyond even 2024, I hope to own this one for many, many years to come.
Yeah, I'll throw in an ETF for the Schwab Dividend Fund, SCHD. Owns a lot of the defensive stocks that, in part, I don't feel like picking or researching. But one of those things where I see myself wanting some dividends in retirement. So that's one that I'm hanging on to. Jason Moser, appreciate your time and your insight.
Thank you.
Before we get to our next segment, first, a couple of ads. Growth stocks steal the spotlight in financial media, but something way more boring is behind a whole lot of wealth creation. Dividends, the regular payments that companies send shareholders. Dividends can make companies a little more disciplined on capital allocation and provide investors long-term streams of income. Some of the Motley Fool analysts behind Stock Advisor, that's our flagship service, put together a list of 3 dividend stocks to buy this year. We're sending this report to Motley Fool Money listeners for free, just as a thank you for checking out the show with no purchase necessary. Just go to fool.com/2024dividends and we'll email it directly to your inbox. We will also include a link in the show notes. Ricky Mulvey with Motley Fool Money here to tell you about a vehicle that is redefining sporting luxury, the Range Rover Sport. The first thing I noticed when I sat down in the driver's seat is that I felt like I was in a cockpit. You're up off the ground in a focused interior that promotes exhilarating driver engagement. I also really appreciated the overhead 360-degree camera view that let me know exactly where I was going as I was backing out of the parking space. I went for a drive in the Range Rover Sport out in Littleton, Colorado, and tested the accelerator just a little bit and felt the performance and agility. It's an instinctive drive with engaging on-road dynamics and effortless composure. To put it plainly, the Range Rover Sport is powerful. It's also quiet and comfortable. Advanced cabin technologies such as active noise cancellation and cabin air purification offer new levels of comfort and refinement. The third generation Range Rover Sport is the most desirable, advanced, and dynamically capable yet. I'd like to invite you to visit LandRoverUSA.com to learn more about the Range Rover Sport. All right, next up, want to get a little more productive in 2024? Allison Southwick and Robert Brokamp have some tips so you can do more in your financial, professional, and personal life.
We're on day two of 2024. So ideally, you've already begun working on your New Year's resolutions. Of course, I don't know what those resolutions are, but chances are that they have something to do with getting stuff done, like exercising more, saving more, spending more time with your family, picking up a new skill, or just being more productive. If so, this episode is for you because Bro has some tips for getting more done financially and otherwise in 2024.
And these tips I learned the hard way because by nature, I'm kind of a distractible procrastinator. And that can cause problems in your personal and professional lives as it did with mine. So about 15 years ago, I kind of became obsessed with productivity. I read hundreds of articles and books, attended conferences, even worked with a couple of coaches. And while I'm far from perfect, I'm a heck of a lot better than I used to be. So what does all this have to do with personal finances? Well, the bottom line is your future net worth is going to be determined by the money-related stuff that you get done. The accounts you open, investments you make, insurance policies you buy, flexible spending reimbursements you submit, and so on. On the flip side, when you look at surveys about financial regrets from older folks, many often have to do with wishing they got something done sooner. People wish they started saving sooner, investing sooner, but they just didn't get around to it. I spoke just the other day with a guy in his 50s, and he still hasn't taken advantage of the higher 401k contribution limits that are available to the 50 and older crowd. And he said what we've all said. He said he's been meaning to do it, but he just hasn't gotten around to it. So we all have these types of things on our to-do list. Hopefully, these tips will help you be able to cross some of them off in 2024.
All right, bro. And your first piece of advice is to have a collection system, which I'm going to be honest, already sounds a bit like work and I don't want to do it.
Unfortunately, it probably is a little work. And, you know, for some people, it's just a regular old to-do list. But it probably better if you have something a little more robust than that, because productivity really starts with having a system that you trust to collect and organize all the items on your to-do list. And really, this is the foundation of the Getting Things Done, otherwise known as GTD, methodology and book developed by David Allen, who's kind of a prominent productivity guru. Many fools, including myself and co-founder David Gardner, have implemented some version of the GTD system. In fact, David Gardner is such a fan, they actually invited Mr. Allen to speak to the company, and he's had him as a guest on his Rule Breaker Investing podcast. And the main idea is that your head is lousy at keeping track of all that you need to do. So you must have a way to collect and organize all your open loops, ideally using a tool that is always with you so you can record things as they occur to you and you can refer to it depending on whatever different context you're in, if you're out, if you're at your computer, if you're at home. For most people, this is their phone, but some people do prefer an old school small notebook. But if you go with your phone, there is just tons of tools and apps you can use as your digital to-do list. I used to use Trello and then I moved to Jira, and you can find plenty of articles online about how to use either of those as a productivity management tool. But now I just use a handy and really pretty simple app called Remember the Milk, and I love it.
All right, your second piece of advice is if it can be done in under 2 minutes, just do it.
Yeah, and this is another GTD principle. Don't take the time to add something to your to-do list, which you know later get reevaluated and shuffled around, if you can just get it done in 120 seconds or less. And a number of important things fall under this category. For example, the contribution limits to 401ks increased by $500 in 2024. So rather than put increased 401k contribution into my to-do list, I just logged into my account and changed the amount, and it took me less than a minute.
I mean, you make it sound so easily, but invariably, I'm going to go to the account, not know my password, immediately get thwarted and distracted.
Yes. So it might make it might take a couple of 2 minute efforts to get it done. But generally speaking, it won't take as long as you think. And if you put it on your to-do list to be done later, chances are that it may not get done.
Yeah, it's ridiculous the number of things I haven't done because I've forgotten a password.
Oh, it's crazy.
I got to get on that. All right, third piece of advice. Plan every month, week, and day.
Yeah, so on my calendar, I have a time on the first day of every month, every Monday and every morning to see what's coming up and decide on my priorities. And some productivity experts recommend that you plan every day the night before so you can hit the ground running when you wake up, but having a planning time at 7 a.m. every day works for me. Also, as part of my Monday planning, my wife and I email each other our schedules and list of important family to-do items so that we're both on the same page for the week. And for me, this planning time has been crucial. It gives me time to process all the items in my to-do list and identify the 3 to 5 things I must get done every day. And I think it is important to be realistic about how much you can get done in any given day. And then I often post those 3 to 5 things on a post-it note, and I have it in front of me throughout the day as a reminder.
All right, which brings us to our next piece of advice, which is to ruthlessly prioritize. Like you said, you can't get everything done in one day.
Exactly. My all-time favorite productivity book is called Eat That Frog, 21 Great Ways to Stop Procrastinating and Get More Done in Less Time by Brian Tracy. And the title of the book comes from a quote attributed to Mark Twain. It is, quote, "If it's your job to eat a frog, it's best to do it first thing in the morning. And if it's your job to eat 2 frogs, it's best to eat the biggest frog first." So for Tracy, the big frogs are the items on your to-do list that will have the biggest impact and result in the most progress toward your goals. And he believes that actions follow the Pareto principle, also known as the 80-20 rule. That is, 80% of results come from the 20% most crucial actions. As he wrote, quote, "There's never enough time to do all the tasks, but there's always time to do the most important task. The most valuable tasks that you can do each day are often the hardest and most complex. But the payoff and rewards for completing these tasks efficiently can be tremendous. For this reason, you must adamantly refuse to work on tasks in the bottom 80% while you still have tasks in the top 20% left to be done." Tracy recommends that you assign letters A through E to all your items on your to-do list, with A tasks being the most important. Those, of course, are the so-called big frogs. When it comes to how to spend your time, this principle is paramount. Never do a B task when there is an A task left to be done. You should never be distracted by a tadpole when there is a big frog sitting there waiting to be eaten. And I will say that I did follow this strategy for a while, like doing, you know, labeling everything A to E. But what you'll find is if you do that enough, it kind of becomes just second nature and you don't have to follow it so strictly. So give it a try in the beginning. And I think even that you'll get better habits to a point where your prioritization just becomes second nature.
All right. Your next piece of advice is to put important items on your calendar.
Yeah, another book I highly recommend is by Sally McGee, and it's called Take Back Your Life, Using Microsoft Office Outlook to Get Organized and Stay Organized. And even if you don't use a Microsoft product, the book is still enlightening. A key component of McGee's methodology is putting important tasks on a calendar. And here I'll provide a quote from her. "Your head and to-do list have no boundaries. They're limitless. Reality lies only in the calendar because it has time limits. Use it as a prioritization tool, and it will assist you to be more strategic about what you can and cannot do." And according to Sally McGee's company's research, there's a 75% greater chance that something will get done if it's scheduled on a calendar. So if there's something that you must get done, put it there on your calendar. Treat it as secret. That way, no one else can bother you. No one else can schedule an appointment over it. And you've allotted a certain time to get that thing done.
Reality lies only in the calendar. That got a lot heavier than I was expecting. Whew, okay. Next piece of advice is that you need to increase focus and block distractions with a tomato.
Yes. Some people are familiar with this, but back in the 1980s, Italian college student Francesco Cirillo, I don't know if that's how you would pronounce it. I'm not Italian, but he figured out that he got more accomplished if he worked in 25-minute bursts followed by 5-minute breaks. And he timed these bursts and breaks with a kitchen timer that was in the shape of a tomato. Thus, this became known as the Pomodoro technique, named after the Italian word for tomato. And so I follow this strategy using an online tomato timer. Just do an online search. You'll find plenty of them out there. And here's the key. During those 25 minutes, you can only work. No checking email, no checking social media, no getting coffee, no going to the bathroom, no chatting with colleagues. Once the 25 minutes are up, you can do any of those things for 5 to 10 minutes, but then the next 25-minute Pomodoro begins.
All right, next piece of advice is to give up on perfection.
Yeah, one of my all-time favorite quotes about productivity comes from David Allen, and it is, "Perfection and productivity are mutually exclusive." And this is because perfectionism can actually cause procrastination. One study found that procrastination was associated with significantly negative automatic thoughts in general, as well as automatic thoughts reflecting the need to be perfect. And as psychology professor and author of the book Solving the Procrastination Puzzle, Tim Peichel, said in a Fast Company interview, Procrastination is not a time management problem, it's an emotion management problem. And the truth is, few things in life need to be absolutely perfect, including your financial plan. Just doing something and getting most of the way there, whether it's saving, investing, insurance, estate planning, whatever, is better than never getting started due to perfectionism. To paraphrase Voltaire, don't let the best be the enemy of the good.
I see. This happens in my family. My dad is very much a jump in and just get it done and don't plan it and whatever, it's done. And he gets things done, like, but not necessarily very well. Whereas my brother is very much like, it's got to be perfect. It's got to be perfect. So it's going to take him a month of getting himself psyched up to do the project. And he's got to watch all these videos. And then when he finally does get around to it, it's done well. But that's how I see that in my family.
It clearly, obviously depends on what you're talking about, right? If someone is designing and building an airplane, you want that to be absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
But when it comes to so much of your personal finance, like I hear people talk about, like, well, I'll increase how much I'm saving retirement. But once I look at my budget and figure out exactly how much I can save, and I say, you know what, just save more now. You'll figure out later whether it was too much or too little, but just do something.
Yeah. I feel like I could be wrong, but I feel like you maybe are a lean to the perfection kind of person, and I'm a get it done, whatever kind of person.
I was, but I got over it.
Yeah.
I got over it. In fact, I really am now. I'm just going to do something and I'll figure it out later.
Oh,
especially
yeah,
with your finances, a lot of things, they're sort of self-correcting. You get a signal ahead of time like, oh, I overdid it or I underdid it, and now I can make a change.
Our last piece of advice is to just get going.
Yeah, in 2017, Axios interviewed Kevin Systrom, who was the co-founder of Instagram, and then at the time, actually, he was the CEO of the company. In response to the question, what's your favorite life hack? Systrom said, if you don't want to do something, make a deal with yourself to do at least 5 minutes of it. And after 5 minutes, you'll end up doing the whole thing. And a similar strategy is recommended by James Clear, author of Atomic Habits, an easy and proven way to build good habits and break bad ones. Clear's version says that any new habit can be boiled down to a 2-minute first step. So start there. So for example, if you want to make exercise a habit, just start by getting ready. Fill up your water bottle, put on your running shoes. That may be enough to get your motivation going. And I'll just add here that James Clear is also the source of one of my other favorite productivity quotes, and that is, we must suffer one of two things, the pain of discipline or the pain of regret.
Again, bring in the heavy this early in the year.
No.
All right, bro. Well, what are your final parting thoughts for our listeners on getting financial things done in the coming year?
So my guess is that you know which financial tasks you've been avoiding, but will have a significant positive impact once they're accomplished, right? Whether it's choosing a money management system, boosting your savings, making an appointment with a financial planner, or maybe an estate planning attorney. Each person's money-related, quote-unquote, big frogs are different. But here's one suggestion that could benefit everyone, and that is put a weekly money hour on your calendar. So as I mentioned earlier, putting a task on your calendar increases the chances that it'll get done. Also, in the course of all my reading about productivity, I learned that many successful people actually have a money appointment on their calendars, an hour each week devoted to tackling all the dollar-related to-dos. So use your hour to pay bills, update your budget, check your portfolio, submit reimbursements, monitor your credit score, all that good stuff, and cross off any other important money-related items. Usually, it won't take a whole hour, but you'll feel much better and likely be much richer over the years by regularly getting your financial things done.
As always, people on the program may own stocks mentioned, and The Motley Fool may have formal recommendations for or against, so don't buy or sell anything based solely on what you hear. I'm Ricky Mulvey. Happy New Year. We'll be back tomorrow. Our podcast is represented by Airwave Media.